morning, we have students here from Madison Community Montessori School. Would those students please stand up? Well, we're delighted to have you all. You may be seated. The court has a national award-winning program by which we invite students to come and listen to oral argument with us. This is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. Students decide to come. They may be given materials about the particular case they're going to listen to. And they may have engaged in some activities relating to the judicial system. When they come, and we have two groups today, Madison Community Montessori and Monroe High School students will be here at 10:45 for the second argument. A justice is assigned to meet with the students and discuss the procedures, not the substantive issues of the cases that we are going to hear. If anyone here would like a copy of a summary of the facts and legal issues in this case, would you raise your hand and we can give you a document? Okay, you have it all. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Students will meet with Justice Prosser during the lunch hour. But everyone's invited. I say students, you're all invited. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And to his left, Justice Patience Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I will call our first case for today, which is Ronald Dactor versus Cavallino, Dale L. Cavallino, 13 AP 1750. And here's the lineup for the argument. Paul Curtis is counsel for Dale Cavallino, Hillsborough Transportation Company and their insurance company, Michigan Miller's Mutual Insurance Company, 25 minutes. 25 minutes, John Orton, representing Ronald J. Dactor and Kathleen M. Dactor. 5 minutes for Attorney Gleister, who is representing the amicus curiae, and 5 minutes for Mr. Curtis in rebuttal. Agreed upon? All right. We'll start with Attorney Curtis. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. First, can you hear me okay?
I think you might raise your microphone a bit, or the podium. Thank you.
How's that?
Better.
Better? All right. Thank you. All right. We're here today to take a look at...
Give us a minute. Fine. Your green light's now on, counsel.
All right. Thank you. We're here today to take a look at a truck driving malpractice jury instruction that was given at the trial court level. And I think we can narrow our issues here today. The Court of Appeals said a couple things that I think Mr. Orton will agree with. We both agree that the ordinary care standard is the standard of care for all drivers on the Wisconsin roads. And the second thing is we both seem to agree that holding Mr. Cavallino to a higher standard of care would be improper in this case. So really all we're looking at is the instruction itself that was given to the jury. And keep in mind that this instruction was modeled after 1023 of the Wisconsin jury instructions. It is, in fact, a malpractice instruction. So we're going to look at that instruction and determine whether or not it held Mr. Cavallino to a higher standard of care, which we think the answer is yes. And number two, whether or not that instruction was prejudicial to the outcome of our trial. And again, we think that answer is yes. The Court of Appeals in this case looked at this particular instruction in addition to some other things, but focusing on this instruction, they looked at it, and the Court of Appeals said without deciding that they used some keywords that I...
Assumed, but with that, but not deciding.
I'm sorry?
Assumed.
They yes. Assumed. They assumed without deciding that the instruction was incorrect, erroneous, and was a misstatement of law, I think were the three descriptions the Court of Appeals gave. So we agree with the Court of Appeals, obviously, on those three things.
Let me just, for clarification, in paragraph 45, it says, the Court of Appeals opinion says, we will assume without deciding that it was error to give the truck driver instruction because of the potential interpretation that would not be a correct statement of the law. But then we conclude that any error was not prejudicial. That's what I recalled, and that's what they said. I heard you say a few other, a little more nuanced, and help me with that, because I only...
Yeah. The other quotes you're after?
Say that again, counsel. I didn't hear you.
Well, let's see. I highlighted them. Okay, paragraph 45, I see that one. Up at paragraph 44, says we see at least some danger that the truck driver instruction could have been interpreted by a jury to suggest that Cavallino should be held to a different, higher standard of care than other drivers because he's a professional truck driver.
The reason I raised my question is I heard, but it was a little difficult in hearing, I heard you say that they assumed and then gave a couple of instances.
Yes.
And I recalled in paragraph 45 that they really just talked about the potential interpretation.
True.
And so they really didn't come down and say there was any error that I saw. But let me know if I missed it. That's my question.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think you're correct. I think they didn't actually decide the issue, but what struck me after reading this case 200 times was...
I've only read it a couple times. So he's gotten 198 more than I have.
You know, they said three different times basically the same thing. You know, if you look at paragraph 36, as we now explain, assuming without deciding, that this portion of the instruction was inaccurate to the extent that it may have suggested that all professional truck drivers, such as Cavallino, must be held to a higher standard of care than other drivers, such as Dactor. So that's paragraph 36, and at the bottom of paragraph 32,
as we now explain, assuming without deciding that this portion of the instruction was inaccurate. Is it correct, counsel, that they, of course, never found any inaccuracy or never determined any inaccuracy?
Not overtly. They didn't actually come down and say, we are deciding that this instruction was inaccurate. That is true.
Yeah, and are you suggesting, and that's okay, I just want to make sure I get it right, are you suggesting that if they didn't do it explicitly, that we can look at this opinion and find implicitly where they're doing it, or aren't you saying that? I just want to know where
they did not do it explicitly. That I do agree with. I think it's implicit that this instruction was wrong.
Why shouldn't commercial drivers have a higher standard of care?
Well, the law in Wisconsin always has been that every driver on the roadways is subject to an ordinary standard of care. And we cited other cases from other jurisdictions that have tackled this, and they've all come down on the same side, saying it doesn't matter if you're a professional driver, a novice driver, or somewhere in between. We are all subject to the same rules of the road. Our rules of the road are set forth in Chapter 346 of the Wisconsin statutes. There are no separate rules of the road for truck drivers. Now, do they have a CDL? Sure they do. But that's, again, issued under Chapter 343 of the Wisconsin statutes, just like my driver's license and yours. Motorcycle driver's licenses, same thing, Chapter 343. It's just a different class of license. There's nothing special about it. I think we've got hung up on the word special in this case.
How did this instruction come about? Was it suggested by the judge? Was it suggested by counsel? What happened?
It was Mr. Orton crafted the instruction, and it came in during the jury instruction conference after 2 weeks of jury trial. We were going through, and this new instruction, I think it was captioned new number 3, truck driver negligence, was crafted by Mr. Orton. And during the conference, and I'm sure he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but he said this is a 1023 jury instruction. It's a malpractice jury instruction. I just took out doctor, lawyer, nurse, and stuck in truck driver. So it is a malpractice instruction.
And you object at the time?
Oh, absolutely, I objected. I think I screamed at one point.
May the record reflect.
No, I did object, and we had a long, long discussion about 1023. And, in fact, I think we took a break at one point because things were getting a little heated, and we came back and tried again. And the judge actually ruled in my favor. And the judge said, no, this instruction is not coming in. This will not come in. And then, you know, Mr. Orton jumped up and he started screaming. This is a big, big deal. This is a big deal. I need this instruction. And the judge gave it some more thought and he said, fine,
Counsel,
you'll get your instruction.
Even if we go your way on that, the bigger hurdle for me is the prejudice issue. So
Understood. Talk
to me about that. Are you saying your client was prejudiced because the jury shouldn't have found the percentages of negligence or the prejudice in the monetary damage, or where are you on that?
All of the above. This instruction changed the outcome, in my opinion.
How so?
Well, because if you look at the instruction, it holds Mr. Cavallino to a different standard of care. This instruction, if you read it closely, and I'm sure you have, I'm not implying that you haven't, but if you read it closely, it talks about Cavallino's duty. It talks of professional truck driver's duty. It doesn't say ordinary care in there anywhere. This is a malpractice instruction. He's held to a different standard of care. And also keep in mind that the juxtaposition of these two instructions were such that
not be asking my question well.
Yes.
Are you saying that they wouldn't have found your client negligent on the facts of this case?
Yes.
You're saying there would have been no negligence. Your None. Client would not have been more negligent.
None would have been a stretch, but less, yes. If he had been treated...
Well, less isn't the same. Are you saying that you think it wouldn't have been the percentages, but your client still would have been more negligent? Or
no,
are you
no, no,
saying
no.
that your client would have been found less negligent than the plaintiff?
Less negligent than the plaintiff, certainly.
Based on the facts that were presented at trial?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, this jury instruction... These two drivers weren't treated the same. That's not fair. You can't have the same ordinary standard of care that applies to every single driver on the Wisconsin roadways and then tell the jury that, except for this guy, you have to treat him differently. He's different. He's got a malpractice instruction. He's got a Cavallino duty. You know, he's got a professional truck driver duty. That's not fair. That's why I screamed so loudly at the jury and trial conference.
Yeah, I'm just trying to translate. Assuming... that you're right,
yep.
And there wasn't proper instruction. When we review the record, is it harmless? That's what I'm trying to get at.
It is not harmless.
Mr. Curtis, this may be very unfair, but your client had a commercial driver's license.
True.
And he was driving a semi.
Right.
I went to the website of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration, In the very first paragraph under commercial driver's license program reads as follows. Driving a commercial motor vehicle requires a higher level of knowledge, experience, skills, and physical abilities than that required to drive a non-commercial vehicle. In order to obtain a commercial driver's license, an applicant must pass both skills and knowledge testing geared to these higher standards. Additionally, CDL holders are held to a higher standard when operating any type of motor vehicle on public roads. Serious traffic violations committed by a CDL holder can affect their ability to maintain their CDL certification. How am I supposed to react to that?
Well, that's not Wisconsin law. I guess that's the easy answer.
When I look under Wisconsin law for CDL, it refers me to the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration website.
The statute does?
The materials for the Wisconsin Department.
I see what you're saying.
Right,
gotcha.
Here. So check out the
okay.
Federal website.
I don't think you're making anything up. I believe you. I guess the way I look at this is Wisconsin law is quite clear that all drivers are subject to Chapter 346 of Wisconsin statutes. There are no special statutes for CDL holders, none. So in this case, we had claims that there was driving too closely, too fast, lookout, you know, things like that, all covered by Wisconsin statute. There are no federal guidelines that are at issue here. All the driving falls under Chapter 346. And in fact, if you look at, I think if you dig a little deeper on that website, you go into the CFR. The CFR specifically states that all truck drivers are subject to the local rules of their jurisdiction, which would be Wisconsin, of course, in this case. So they steer the truck driver back to the laws of Wisconsin. Now, you know, the higher standard of care is probably what you're most concerned about on that website. Again, I don't know what to tell you, that the website holds them to a higher standard of care. Wisconsin law does not. There's nothing in the history of Wisconsin law that holds truck drivers to a higher standard of care.
Okay. I'm sorry, are you done?
Go ahead.
One. First, seems to me your briefs argue that there should be absolutely no instruction here relating to the particular driver's capability as a driver, whether he's got a commercial license, whether he drives a race car professionally.
Right.
Now, regardless of what the qualities of the particular defendant, or it could be plaintiff, but here it's defendant, are, no instruction should be given. The only instruction that should be given is the usual standard of care, reasonable care under the circumstances. Period. Is that your position?
Absolutely.
I thought so. Okay. Your fallback position in this case, if I understand it, is, okay, court, if you think that there's a special circumstance depending on the type of driver we're dealing with, race car driver, commercial vehicle driver, et cetera, then you have to make it clearer than this particular instruction, that this particular instruction changed the duty of care instead of looking at the circumstances of the driver. Is that your fallback position?
I think that's right.
And that the jury could have misinterpreted this instruction to be a change of duty of care.
Right.
And that's prejudicial.
Absolutely.
Okay. Either because of the percentages of negligence and contributory negligence, And I don't know if you think it affects damages.
No, I think we're stuck with the damages the way they are. We did challenge some of the damage instructions, but those were shot down below. And my understanding of Wisconsin law is, and you guys obviously have a better understanding, but if we end up retrying this at some point, it's liability only.
Mm-hmm. But the prejudice here is because you upped the standard of, because the court upped the standard of care for the defendant, making the defendant rise to a higher standard of care. Therefore, the jury could put a higher percent on your client.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
As I understand your argument, and if I don't understand it, you should correct me.
No, I think you understand it just fine.
Now you can take over.
Pardon?
I said now you can take over the argument.
I would have a question, though, before you take
yeah.
over. And I'm returning to the issue of prejudice.
Yes.
I need you to tell me what's wrong with this view or address my view and explain your position.
Okay.
When I look at the Court of Appeals opinion, going back to that, that's one of the first things I do in my preparation. And I read the facts section. Don't even get to the discussion. Didn't even get to the issue.
Yes.
The facts section.
Yes.
State, it seems to me your problem is this person, Hoyland. That's the problem with your case. Paragraph 8 says, Hoyland testified that while stopped at the intersection, waiting to turn left, he glanced in his rearview mirror and saw, quote, a big truck coming down on top of me. And then apparently, according to Hoyland's testimony, he was stopped in the lane and he was going to turn left. Now, your client says it's different. Your client says Hoyland had already executed his left turn. Hoyland says, no, that the truck veered off to the right, apparently, according to paragraph 8. And so when I read that and then read the contrary testimony of Cavallino, and then going through paragraph 14 where it says it's a 65-35, I say to myself, well, that's reasonable. Sounds like a 65-35. If you didn't have Hoyland, might not be. But with Hoyland, it sounds reasonable. So respond to why it isn't just, okay, no prejudice, because it sounds like a 65-35 case regardless of legal issues. The facts are 65-35 with Hoyland. Respond to that.
Well, I'm glad you weren't on the jury. That's number one.
Well, no, I mean,
I understand.
You've got Hoyland. He's a problem for
I don't think.
Case.
I don't think he's a problem.
I don't know if he's a problem. All I know is what the Court of Appeals said.
Sure. No, I understand. And I'm being a little flippant. I'm just joking around. But you know, here's the testimony as it relates to Mr. Hoyland. There are two versions to this story, at least as I see it. Mr. Hoyland is either there or he's not there. Mr. Hoyland puts himself there, and he's a nice, excitable old fella. He was fun to have at trial. But what he says, I am there, I see this truck coming down on top of me. You know, those are his excitable words. When we asked him, Mr. Hoyland, was there any point in time where you feared that you were going to be rear-ended, that this truck was going to hit you, Mr. Cavallino's truck? And he said, no. He said, he took the lane and went around me. There's a bypass lane, so he was in the other lane. He's in a separate lane. Cavallino's in a different lane, according to Hoyland. So that is not a problem. It's a bypass lane. So our position at trial is this. Hoyland remembers the facts one way. Cavallino, Townley, who is an independent witness, has nothing to do with this case, and Dahlberg, another truck driver at the same location, all say Hoyland is not there. Not there. Makes his turn beforehand.
Mm-hmm. That's not what the Court of Appeals has as their facts, however.
True. Yeah. That is absolutely true, that they don't have those facts. They didn't get all the facts right.
Let me ask this. If you read the Court of Appeals facts, do you think 65-35 is in the ballpark?
Based on their facts?
Yeah.
No, I don't. No. I still don't agree. No. If there's a point in time, well, I don't even want to get into that because Horton will run with it. So So, no, I disagree with this. I don't think under any stretch of the imagination is 65-35 reasonable. None. I think this instruction tipped the scales, and that was unfair.
And your response, besides the instruction to me, is that there's more testimony that would influence an assessment of percentages than it appears.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, if you look at the officer who investigated this case, she talked to Cavallino, she talked to Hoyland, and she testified at trial. Hoyland was a non-factor,
I'm sorry, what was a non?
Hoyland was a non-factor.
Non-factor, what? What's the rest of the sentence?
Cause of the accident. He had nothing to do with it. He was just...
Yeah, well, I don't think you'd find any negligence on Hoyland.
Oh, no. Facts. No, but, I mean, one of the spins on the facts is that Cavallino came within inches of rear-ending Hoyland, which is baloney.
But he also moved into the right lane in order to avoid Hoyland, and there's a question as to whether or not that is appropriate driving to pass the car on the right lane, right?
Yeah, actually, okay. Exactly right, because under the statute, if you're going to use the bypass lane, you must do so in safety. So the safety issue was heavily litigated.
Now, I got you to where you believe that the duty of care is the same for all people, right?
Right.
Reasonable care under the circumstances, right? Okay. And you object to any special instructions relating to the particular driver's capability as a driver, right?
Yes.
Medical malpractice instruction on expertise doesn't come into play here on driving. See Saxby, right?
Right.
I mean, that's your position. All right. But would you agree that in determining negligence in any particular case, you look at the circumstances of the particular parties? It's an objective standard, but it's not this reasonable person out there that we don't know, we can't see, we don't know anything about. It's a reasonable person under the circumstances of these drivers, under these circumstances of a wet night, was it night? I think it was night, in Wisconsin, with driving a tractor and driving a car. You agree with that, right?
Yes, I do. I think 1005 has that built in, same or similar circumstances.
So all the evidence, I shouldn't say all, the evidence relating to your client as to what he does and his training and his expertise could come in, right?
Yeah, it comes in. It's more background information.
Right. It's part of the circumstances,
sure.
Right?
I agree.
So you look at those circumstances, and that is the general negligence standard. So your objection is only that it is specified here and specified in a way that it could be confused, if I understand this case.
Yes, I think that is an accurate way to put it. The malpractice, trucking malpractice instruction, first of all, I object to having the separate instruction calling out one driver when they're both subject to the same standard. That makes no sense to me. Why is a special instruction needed? Secondly, the way it was phrased, talking about Cavallino's duty and a professional truck driver's duty, it treats this. Oh, my red light is on.
You may finish the question.
It treats this as a malpractice case, and it is not.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Orton.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is John Orton. I represent the plaintiff's respondents, Ron and Kathy Dactor, who are joining us today in the courtroom. The Court has correctly identified that there are two issues facing the Court. The first issue goes to the very heart of Wisconsin jurisprudence regarding negligence. We ask this Court to affirm that this instruction was a correct statement of the law because it was entirely proper for the jury to be instructed that Mr. Cavallino, a semi-truck driver, had a duty to use the care, skill, and judgment which a reasonable semi-truck driver should exercise in the same or similar circumstances. That is now and always has been the definition of ordinary care. This instruction didn't change that. This instruction didn't try to change that. And I agree with Mr. Curtis in his opening statement that we agree that ordinary care is the standard of care to be applied here. The second issue is reached only if you conclude that the truck driver instruction was erroneous. And if erroneous, you have to determine whether it was prejudicial. One of the advantages of having some time between the filing of briefs and coming here for oral argument is you get a chance to take a step back and perhaps see the forest for the trees. And so I'm going to try to begin my substantive comments by telling the court what I think the big picture is here, or why I think we're really here. And the reason I think we're here is because of paragraph 47 of the Court of Appeals decision. Because in paragraph 47, I think the court used some language which Cavallino has grabbed and has misconstrued and has formulated this argument that basically says that we shouldn't use the special skills doctrine in Wisconsin. Permit me to give a little preface to that. As Justice Bradley has already kind of pointed out, in paragraph 37, the Court of Appeals notes that both parties agree that the standard of care is ordinary care. Mr. Curtis has said that. I agree with that. In paragraph 41, the court goes on to say that not only is the standard of care ordinary care, but Wisconsin has long recognized what we have labeled for purposes of this appeal the special skills doctrine. I would note parenthetically that this court has never identified a special skills doctrine in Wisconsin. Instead, the notion of special skills has always been part and parcel of the very fabric of our negligence doctrine. Then in paragraph 43, the Court of Appeals says the substance of the truck driver instruction was correct. And again, I think Justice Bradley hit it on the head when she said that although the substance of the instruction was correct, maybe there was the potential for a juror to be misled. So we're dealing with that potential here. And then in paragraph 47, the Court of Appeals begins its explanation of why the instruction was not prejudicial. And the court explains that the special skills doctrine is not easy to expound all the time. It can sometimes maybe confuse a juror. They quoted from Levine versus Clear Creek Skiing, which said that sometimes it can create the impression that a double standard of care exists. And then the court used the following phrase and said, quote, when the superior knowledge or skills doctrine applies, it has the practical effect of holding an actor to a higher standard of conduct. No court, no learned treatise, no jury instruction, and no restatement says that application of the special skills doctrine holds an actor to a higher standard of conduct. And that's the thrust of their argument. They've grabbed that language from paragraph 47, and the thrust of their argument is Cavallino was held to a higher standard of care, and indeed he was not.
Counsel, is it correct, the representation that's been made, that what you did is you took a medical malpractice instruction and took out doctor and essentially put in truck driver, and that's kind of the composition of the instruction that you asked the court to give?
Close. Not entirely accurate. I didn't take a medical malpractice instruction. Whenever you're crafting, at least whenever I'm crafting an instruction to fit the peculiar circumstances of my case, I always start with the pattern instructions, and I try to find an instruction that is close to the issue at hand. And in this case, we have in the pattern jury instructions a number of instructions that apply the special skills doctrine. We have instructions that apply special skills doctrine to contractors, insurance agents, teachers, architects, chiropractors, doctors. And the one that I found to be most applicable, at least I thought, was the one that applied it to licensed technicians and licensed nurses. Because like a licensed technician, this truck driver had special skills, special knowledge, special licensing, special testing. He has a special set of rules and regulations that he must follow. If he does not follow those, he will lose his license and suffers penalties far beyond what a regular...
Sir, all of the instructions that you mentioned appear to me to have the actor act in a context separate and apart from the general public, where driving an automobile is something I do. Driving an automobile is something that a commercial truck driver does. We both use the same roadway. But when I go to a doctor, I expect him to know more than me, and I'm not ever operating in his arena. When there's a licensed technician, a radiology technician, or a dental technician, I don't have those skills, and I do not operate in that context. So to apply them in a context such as we have here, where the defendant and the plaintiff are operating in the same context, they're driving a car on Wisconsin highways, frankly, to me, seems a stretch. Do you want to tell me why I'm on the wrong track here?
Well, I believe you're on the wrong track, Justice, because Wisconsin has always recognized the special skills doctrine. And then the question,
But they apply it in a context where those with the skills operate and work. We're applying in a context where people without special skills also operate. You see, maybe I'm not
I see the point you're making, but I think if you apply the special skills doctrine to a building contractor, for example, there are lots of people that work in that trade and are affected by that building contractor, not just the person that hired him, but anybody who is subjected to the work that he performs that could be injured by the work that he performs.
But I think Justice Rogensack's point, which is similar to one of the concerns I've had in preparing for this case, is that most of the general public does not act as a building contractor, whether a general or a sub. Along the lines, most of the public is not employed in any of the specialized areas of labor and or professions which you have enumerated. And I wonder if you can point to any authority where the special skills doctrine has been assigned to a citizen who is engaging in conduct that the average citizen, I mean, most of us who are of age, of the proper age, most of us in this room, I'd wager, have driver's license. And some of us drive a lot more than others. And so, please.
Well, I would say, Justice, that in this particular case, Mr. Cavallino was not engaged in something that you all or that we all engage in. Now, everyone here...
That's because he was driving a semi-truck?
Yeah, everyone here is an experienced driver. We probably all got our licenses around the age of 16. But there isn't anybody in this room that I think would feel comfortable going downstairs and climbing behind the wheel of a semi, pulling a trailer filled with 80,000 pounds of potatoes. That is a special skill. It is a special skill to operate that instrumentality, and that was recognized by the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration and the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Act, which in the 70s and 80s recognized that we had a problem on our highways because we had people that didn't have special skill.
In order to apply the specialized skill doctrine, the court should look at what kind of vehicle the one held to have superior knowledge and or skill was operating at the time of the incident.
A little more than that, I think that in applying the special skills doctrine, the court should determine whether or not special skill was required by the actor, by the tortfeasor. And frankly, we already do that in every single case. Because in almost every single case, when there are special skills involved, we bring in an expert witness to tell the jury what is the standard of care that an electrician or a plumber, or a forklift driver, or a bulldozer operator, what is the special care that that person needs to know in order to operate it safely?
Well, I guess I'm trying to pinpoint when exactly is someone going to be held to that kind of specialized skill. I note, for instance, this discussion is calling to mind the subject of a photograph which hangs in my chambers. It's of a much younger, thinner Mike Gableman with a full head of hair standing in front of the concrete truck that he drove in order to support his way through school. And I consider that I'd probably be hesitant to climb behind the wheel of a semi, but I think I could handle the concrete truck still. So am I, because I engaged in that activity, these 20 years ago, am I now held to a specialized skill or a higher? You're trying to make the distinction. Problem I have with this case is the very close, and I'm still. I just want to signal you this because I'm not. I don't think I'm the only one on this bench who's having difficulty with the idea that this is not a double standard. Yeah. Okay.
At the time the tort is committed or allegedly committed, if the actor is engaged in a trade, occupation, or profession that requires him to have special licensing, which can only be achieved through special testing and skill and knowledge, then under those circumstances, that person, in jury instructions, the jury instructions should identify that that person must employ those special skills and knowledge.
What if Cavallino's license had expired the day before the accident?
I would say that because he was engaged and represented to the traveling public as he came down the highway, he represents to all of us that he is engaged in the profession of truck driving and by law is required to have a license, that he would be held to that higher standard or to the special skills doctrine. It doesn't impose a higher standard. It's the standard of ordinary care that a semi-truck driver should exercise under the same or similar circumstances, given due regard for his level of training and knowledge.
If he weren't driving a truck and he were just in his car or his minivan,
then that instruction would not have been given. Right. If if a person is driving a bus or a taxi, we already have a so-called special skills doctrine. It's the common carrier instruction. But I believe that, if the special skills doctrine is to mean anything in Wisconsin, it has to be presented to the court or presented to the jury in the form of a jury instruction to tell them that if a person with special skills, in this case, special skills clearly licensed, they must exercise ordinary care by exercising that degree of care, skill, and judgment which a reasonable truck driver should exercise under the same or similar circumstances.
Does your doctrine, your theory apply in the reverse? I've been driving a car since I was 15 years old. In Illinois, you could get licensed at 15, and I was, and I have, and I've always driven. So I've driven for a long, 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 long time. Now,
about 20 years, Justice?
At least 20 years, that's right. So if a new driver who just gets his license, say he's now 18 years old, so he's had it long enough that he's not a probationary driver anymore, is he held to a lesser standard of care than I am because I have so much more experience than he does?
No, experience alone or age alone does not define your special skill. It does not. You can be a truck driver who's only driven for one day, but if you have a commercial driver's license and you've gone through the testing and you have demonstrated that you have the special knowledge and skill that it takes to pass that testing and operate that vehicle, then you are held to the standard of ordinary care of all reasonable truck drivers under the same or similar circumstances. It makes no difference whether that truck driver is a 40-year veteran or a four-day veteran. Similarly to doctors, we have a special skills instruction for doctors. Mr. Curtis labeled it a malpractice instruction, but really it's just a special skills instruction. And in that instruction, we don't tell juries that, if this is a new doctor and therefore you don't hold him to the same standard as the average reasonable doctor under the same or similar circumstances. So age has nothing to do with it, and that's what the Fredericks case said that was quoted initially in the blue brief, and we responded to it in the red brief. But You know, if we... Well, let me go at it this way. We have a situation where how do we present to a jury the special skills doctrine? If we're going to require actors to exercise their special skill or knowledge, we do so because it's intricately connected to the duty of care and the foreseeability of harm. We all know that the duty of care is based upon foreseeability of harm. And so if you have special skill, special knowledge, you may have the ability to foresee harm, and therefore you have to exercise that foreseeability of harm when you exercise ordinary care, your duty of care. Imagine what the world would be like if that wasn't the case. I'm a forklift driver. I'm not a professional. There's no forklift malpractice instruction. I'm a forklift truck driver, and I drive my forklift in such a way that I knock over racks of things and it crushes a bunch of my coworkers. I think that in any situation like that, we would instruct the jury that that forklift driver had an obligation to exercise that degree of care, skill, and judgment which a reasonable forklift driver would exercise under the same or similar circumstances, and that has always been the definition of negligence in Wisconsin. It is a application of the special skills doctrine to a particular set of circumstances.
Do you have an example that you can give me where the two actors are operating in the same context? Okay, the people walking around when the forklift driver knocks over stuff, they're not forklift drivers. They're not operating in the forklift driver's context. Now, if you had two forklift drivers and somehow they got in a collision, to me that'd be more similar to what we're talking about here. I'm still concerned that you have two actors operating in one context, and you're giving them two different obligations on how they operate. That's what's bothering me,
and I'm not
on your page.
My response, Justice, is that I'm not giving them two different obligations. They both have the duty to exercise ordinary care. However, under the special skills doctrine, if one of the actors has special skill, knowledge, in this case licensing, his exercise of ordinary care, it's still ordinary care applicable to everybody, but his ordinary care requires him. Now,
Do you have any examples where you have somebody that's two licensed people operating in the same context and what ordinary care requires of them bears on the special skill that they have?
I can't think of one off the top of my head, Justice. There is a case that was cited in the briefs which involved an accident. A car decided to do a U-turn on a freeway, and as it did the U-turn on a freeway, two separate trucks came down and collided with this car. And ultimately, the jury found that the trucks were not negligent, but the operator of the car was negligent. It was a case brought by the passenger in that car. And the court ruled that the truck drivers had not, the jury had not been instructed that the truck drivers had a special care or superior skills in the operation of their truck. And the court ruled that they should have been instructed that they had superior skills, but in this case, it was not prejudicial because they basically looked at the facts and said, there's no negligence on these trucks anyway. We had a crazy car driver that pulled a U-turn on a freeway.
Mr. Orton, if I may, I think from what I'm listening very, very carefully to you, and I think the answer, correct, and I stand to be correct, I think your answer to both Justice Rogensack and my own question would be you can't point to such a case because, by definition, a proper subject for such an instruction would never involve the two actors. You are making a differentiation here. You are saying that, yes, well, they both fall under the general activity of operating a motor vehicle, one person operating a regular passenger vehicle, the other operating a semi truck and trailer rig that would require, as you say, the specialized license, the specialized training, the specialized skill to handle and safely operate such a truck. So well, yes, it seems to me, if I may be so bold as to suggest an answer to you, it seems to me what you're saying is, yes, they're both driving, but there is a distinction to be made between both the skill necessary, the vehicles that they're driving, the requisite knowledge, and the requisite licensing. So by definition, the two will never be on the same plane.
By definition, one of the two should have a special skills doctrine applied to them. Let me try this example. Justice Rogensack, let's assume that you come over to my house for dinner and we're talking and you tell me that the court deals with gun cases a lot and you don't know much about guns, and I go into my basement and I bring out three or four different kinds of guns, a lever action, a pump action, a bolt action, a revolver, an automatic, and we're showing those guns and I have some knowledge about guns. I own these guns. I've had them. I'm a gun user, so on and so forth, but you know nothing about them. And the guns go off and they injure you badly. The question is, would the jury be not instructed that I had any special knowledge or skill regarding those guns such that I had no obligation to share my special knowledge or skill with you? Were we truly on the same level? I would suggest no. Ordinary care applies to both of us. We both had an obligation to exercise ordinary care, but because I had special knowledge and skill regarding those guns and the handling of those guns and the care of those guns, I think the jury should be instructed that Orton had an obligation to exercise that degree of care which a reasonable gun owner knowledgeable of those guns would exercise under the same or similar circumstances.
Well, just think, anybody that has guns and has them loaded and looks at them and fools around with them has violated it, no matter how little or how much skill you have. And I think that's where the instruction would probably come down.
But well, maybe it's a bad example. I'm doing my best to come
up with one. I know I'm throwing you something that's not in your brief. I'm just trying to tell you what's bothering me.
Sure. Justice Prosser has a question.
Could I give you a hypothetical? Let's suppose we have a commercial truck driver who's driving his private vehicle, let's say a Ford Fusion.
Sure.
He's driving down the highway at 65 miles an hour. How long he slams on the brakes before his car comes to a stop, and then compare that to the same driver driving 65 miles an hour on the same highway. How long does it take his truck to stop? And when it's full or when it's empty? I mean, doesn't a truck driver by virtue of experience know that there are going to be different stopping distances
and all
of these things?
Once you get into a case like this, you realize all the things that truck drivers know. What's the position of his load? Is it a full trailer or an empty trailer? I didn't know that empty trailers take much longer to stop than a full trailer. Okay. Is the load over the rear axle or over the front axle? What kind of air brake system does he have set up? Because different air brake systems take different amounts of time to engage.
What I hear you saying and what I hear some of my colleagues asking you, and frankly one of the best points as far as I'm concerned that you made and make your position more appealing to me, is if he weren't driving truck, he wouldn't be held to the standard.
Right.
Because he was driving a truck, he should be treated like a semi-truck driver. If he were driving his minivan, that would be the sensible stopping point. The jury isn't instructed that he's, you know, Mario Andretti driving a minivan. The jury wouldn't be instructed that he's a racetrack driver.
He is not engaged in exercising the special skill and knowledge of his licensing when he's driving the family van to church.
To the extent that there's a limit on your argument, the limit is when you are acting in the capacity that requires you to use that special skill.
Yes. And I think that's the special skills doctrine, which is incorporated into the restatements repeatedly, learned treatises. I mean, Wisconsin is not out on a limb at all regarding this particular doctrine. I see that my red light up is up. It's always a great honor to appear in front of this court. Thank you very much for hearing our case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Giesner.
May it please the court, I'm Attorney Bill Gleisner, and I appear on behalf of Amicus Curiae, the Wisconsin Association for Justice, which in this particular case supports the respondents. I've listened to this colloquy with interest, and I think it comes down to an issue of standards and standards that apply to a jury trial. I'd like to start, if I may, by talking about what might be the proper management of a jury trial and especially the giving of jury instructions. That management is clearly vested in the sound discretion of the trial court. As this court has said, quote, a circuit court has broad discretion when instructing a jury. As a general matter, if we determine that the overall meaning communicated by the instruction as a whole was a correct statement of the law and the instruction comported with the facts of the case at hand, no grounds for reversal exists. Now, besides challenging a jury instruction, the respondents are also asking this court to revisit some of the ancient principles of Wisconsin's jurisprudence of negligence, such as Paul's Graph versus Long Island Railroad and Osborne versus Montgomery. I'll pass right to Osborne versus Montgomery. That case, it's an interesting case, very interesting. That case is actually about how you craft a proper jury instruction for negligence. And the Osborne court specifically stated that, quote, if an actor has superior perception or possesses superior knowledge, he is required to exercise his superior powers in determining whether or not his conduct involves an unreasonable risk of injury, close quote. I would respectfully submit that Osborne remains good law, and the echo of Osborne can be heard today in the jury instructions referenced at page 14 of the respondent's brief and in the instruction which was given in the case at bar.
Counsel, do you have a position on whether, if the court were to conclude the instruction was wrong, that it was not prejudicial because of the factual evidence that came in, and if you, I understand, read the briefs, is exposed fully in the brief of the respondent?
I appreciate that question, Justice Rogan-Sack, and yes, I do. As the respondents put it, the heart of this case was the 9 days of testimony regarding the facts and not the 9 seconds when the instruction was read to the jury. And in answer to your question further, Justice, I would reference some of the basic holdings that this court has made regarding the sacrosanct nature of a jury instruction. As noted at page 9 of our amicus brief, this court has made the following very, very clear. Appellate courts must sustain a jury verdict if there's any credible evidence to support it. In applying the standard, the courts must consider the evidence in a light most favorable to the jury's determination. And finally, courts must uphold a verdict even though the evidence may be contradicted by evidence which may seem stronger and more convincing. Following up on those standards, Justice Rogan-Sack, I would say here that there was 9 days of testimony. The testimony involved a truck which did swerve, and it swerved, according to a preponderance of the evidence, to avoid the car driven by Hoyland, I think that's the name. And it did go into the intersection at 40 miles per hour, and the experts, including the petitioner's own experts, testified that that was negligence. And I think that you have here a situation where a great deal of catastrophic harm was done by a truck driver who, after 31 years of driving, should have known better. Now, I think that I certainly do not believe that the instruction is wrong. I think it is completely consistent with Wisconsin law, but I think it's harmless error in view of what I've just said. I will touch briefly on, because I think it's relevant, the case of Paul's Graph versus Long Island Railroad. In their reply, the petitioners appear to argue that Cavallino only owed a duty to use his special driving skills if he was retained by a plaintiff. In other words, he had some kind of professional relationship with the plaintiff. However, Wisconsin has long relied on Judge Andrews' dissent in Paulsgraf, and that dissent holds, quote, everyone owes to the world at large a duty to refrain from acts that may unreasonably threaten the safety of others, close quote. And this court has extrapolated from Paulsgraf that a party is negligent when he commits an act when some harm to someone is foreseeable. Once negligence is established, the defendant is liable for unforeseeable consequences, and he is liable to unforeseeable plaintiffs. Paulsgraf's dissent is adopted in Wisconsin is about foreseeability, and we believe the respondents have it right when they state, quote, the duty of care is connected to foreseeability of harm, and the foreseeability of harm is connected to the knowledge and skill of the defendant. Thank you very much, Justices.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Curtis?
I've got 4 points I'd like to hit before I get out of here today. Number one, if Wisconsin adopts this jury instruction that was created on the malpractice 1023 instructions, Wisconsin would be the first state in the United States to do something like this. I would ask you and your very able clerks, take a look at the Cervelli case. A very, very similar jury instruction was offered in Cervelli. And the Cervelli court, the trial court actually rejected it and said, no way am I giving this one. And it went up on appeal to the Court of Appeals and then up to the Supreme Court in Wyoming. And the Supreme Court in Wyoming said, this is a malpractice instruction. It holds truck drivers to a malpractice standard. We will not do that.
This is 661 Pacific 2nd, 1032.
That is exactly right.
And it's
footnote 1, I believe.
Let me read you what I derived from that case. Let's see if we agree. A jury can consider professional truck drivers' skills and training, but cannot hold them to a higher standard of care.
Yeah, and here's what happened.
Isn't that what Wyoming said?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that what the Wyoming court said?
Yes. However, I would just point out a difference there. What they did is they took the 1005 standard of care instruction, and they modified it to exclude special training and skills. So they toyed with 1005, and so.
Couldn't the jury consider the professional truck driver's skills and training in that case?
In that case?
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's what they decided, but they said that the malpractice instruction was not correct.
Okay.
So, but they relied on 1005.
They didn't like the instruction, but the special skills concept was adopted in Wyoming.
In Wyoming it was. That is true.
I just want to make sure my notes are
understood.
Right.
Understood.
Counsel, I want you to talk about harmless error. You didn't
yes.
talk about it first go round, and I asked Amicus about it because it got missed, that we got all involved in something else.
Right.
Respondent's
right.
argument. I want you to tell me why, if the instruction is wrong, if I agree with you, why it's not harmless error.
Okay. In this case, the jury decided this case because the two drivers were held to different standards. That is not fair. That is not what Wisconsin law is set up to hold. Wisconsin law treats everybody the same. We all follow the same rules of the road under Chapter 346. That was not done in this case. What happened in this case is Judge Romer, who I respect, he gave an instruction he should not have given, and he told the jury.
Okay, I got that. I got all of
okay.
it. I want you to respond to what respondent said in his brief, which part of it was talked to about from the attorney for the amicus about Mr. Calvello came into the intersection at 40 miles an hour. He didn't brake at all until the point of impact. He swerved around instead of slowing down when he had someone in front of him turning left. There are just a lot of facts that are in the brief that it's argued to us that even if the instruction was wrong, with these facts, you're still going to end up with the defendant being more negligent than the plaintiff. That's what I want you to respond to.
Okay. If you look at the facts from the witnesses to the accident, the facts are much different than are presented in the brief of Mr. Dactor. And I'm sorry, but that's just the truth. There are two ways this accident happened, and neither one of the versions is Cavallino negligent. He's either in the bypass lane. He's entitled to be in the bypass lane. If Mr. Dactor does not turn into his path, no accident. And if Mr. Hoyland is gone and he goes straight through, Mr. Dacter turns into his path. Mr. Dacter turns into his path. Every single scenario, Mr. Dacter turns into the path of a moving semi. There's no braking because there's no time to brake. I mean...
Well, there's, you know, you're still... I don't think that the jury concluded that Mr. Dacter was not negligent. Obviously, they assigned him a significant amount of negligence.
Sure.
But just because the other driver on the road does something screwy that they shouldn't do, and so their negligence, it doesn't absolve the person who didn't start the chain of events in motion from any obligation. You have an obligation to maintain a lookout, to keep your vehicle under control. I mean, the rules of the road go on to give us all continuing duties, regardless of what the other guy is doing on the
right,
highway.
Right. Okay? Right. And my take on this jury instruction is Judge Romer tells this jury through this instruction, and it's hammered on in the closing, is you treat Mr. Cavallino differently. This is an unavoidable accident, but he's got a CDL, so he should be able to avoid this accident.
Okay.
Red light's on. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Counsel, on behalf of the court, I want to thank all three counsel, attorneys Curtis, Orton, and Gleiser, for their presentations today on yet another negligence case and yet another auto accident case, and going all the way back to Paul's graph and all the way forward to commercial drivers. That ends our hearing on 2013 AP 1750, Adactor versus Cavallino. The court will take a few minutes in recess so that these students, if they wish, may leave. Other students may come in. We are in recess.